What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin, along with John Krofcik.
I'm here.
John, have you traveled to the Grand Canyon?
No, I want to see that. I want to go out west. Me and the wife are going to plan a trip and go out there and see the Grand Canyon and see, you know, go to Wyoming, too. I want to see the national parks out there. And
where's that, the Grand Teton? The Grand Teton?
I don't know, Yellowstone is out
there. Yellowstone, yeah. Jellystone.
Jellystone.
Yeah, Yogi Bear.
Yogi and Boo-Boo.
Yeah, of course. No, I want to make the big Western swing, too. Are you going to take an RV, or what are you going to do?
I was pondering getting a little pop-up, you know? You know, and drag it along in the back of the car.
So not something that you would drive. Yeah. I mean, you'd drive regular.
I was thinking about that. Yeah. I enjoy driving, and while I still can.
I know. Well, there are so many rental opportunities, but I think many of us would like to get out and really see some parts, particularly Big Sky Country. I think all of us would like to do that. And we want to make certain that the Big Sky Country that we all imagine, or the desert, or that beauty of the western part of America is preserved. I mean,
absolutely.
That's one thing. I hope we can all agree on that.
Oh, yes.
But public lands are being chopped up and parceled out, and they're not being protected quite as well as you and I might hope, John, at this moment in time. And even these rights, I don't know if you've been reading, but the Trump administration wants to take away certain rights that states have, which is a little unusual. The GOP seems to like states' rights, but in this case, they want to be able to decide if oil and gas exploration can be done and supersede what it is that state officials want to do with some of these lands.
Yeah, see, that's not right, I don't think. I think the states should have control over what goes on in their borders. They also have a lot of fights about between the federal government and ranchers about, you know, grazing and stuff. I mean, there seems to be more and more fights about that.
Yeah, there is a lot of that conflict that is going on. But this book that we are going to be highlighting today is called Grand Canyon for Sale. And obviously, that's meant to get our attention. But I think it's emblematic of the fight that is going on that many people don't see and don't understand. Public lands versus private interests in the era of climate change. And Stephen Nash, who's written about these topics many times in many different places, is just remarkable in his understanding. And we start with him trying to help us capture the beauty and the majesty of the Grand Canyon.
Yeah, he was great.
He really was.
Yeah.
So I want to get right into this because I think it's such an important topic. We love to look at trends that deal with the natural environment, how well we're protecting it, how much we are allowing to go to more private interests. And I will admit, John, there is a lot of land in America, and we do get into the numbers in this podcast, that is owned by the federal government. I mean, we have to recognize that it is not there for developers to come along unless we decide that we are going to limit the amount of public land that we have. But the public lands were put aside. And, of course, Ken Burns did the entire series saying this was the best idea America ever had.
Yeah. We'd be stupid to sell that. I mean, once you lose it, you can't get it back.
Exactly.
I mean, so we need to preserve that forever.
And let's be honest. These private interests are rather rapacious. They are doing it for a motive that is purely to profit some private interest. And now these lands are set aside for all of us. And by the way, there are many different jurisdictional issues. We get into all of that today. So once you listen to this podcast, if you're going to have a debate with somebody about public lands, how well we are claiming the West for our own still to this day, you're going to have a lot of ammunition after you listen to this episode of America Trends. The book is called Grand Canyon for Sale, Public Lands versus Private Interests in the Era of Climate Change. Stephen Nash, who writes about a lot of this natural wonder and does such a remarkable job. Stephen, thank you so much for this book. And I'll tell you, just the first chapter, where you describe the majestic beauty and the complexity of the ecosystem of the Grand Canyon. In a very brief moment, could you share that with our listeners?
Grand Canyon's a familiar calendar shot for all of us, and hundreds of millions of us have been to the Grand Canyon since 100 years ago when it was protected and created as a national park. It's an extraordinary place, not only for what you see on the calendar, though, that absolutely stunning kind of cathedral of rock. It's also remarkable for the life inside the canyon. A couple of thousand species of plants, 100 kinds of mammals, lots of amphibians and reptiles, and hundreds of birds. It's just a gorgeous place for its natural life as well as for those beautiful sandstone cliffs. One of the things I appreciated most when I could see it and when I could hear it, or I should say not hear it, was the solitude. Grand Canyon's a million acres, and there are places there, lots of them, most of the canyon, in fact, where you can't see anything that was made by humans. You can't hear anything of human activity. The people you do meet for that reason are extremely friendly and just really happy to be there.
The National Parks, America's best idea. When you think about it, one-third of American land publicly owned. That seems remarkable, even against the backdrop of other nations long established before our own. Is that remarkable in and of itself? But more importantly, how are we managing those lands?
It really is extraordinary that over time, our grandparents and great-grandparents, they had to fight to do it, but they set aside one-third of the nation, as you said, the national landscape. That's about a million square miles as public lands. They're federal public lands that we all own and that we're the trustees of. And what an opportunity that is for the future, because this is really a crucial time.
Your book is called Grand Canyon for Sale, and that certainly got my attention. Is it really for sale, and what's going on in terms of these private interests? We've read a lot of stories from time to time. We've been a little bit concerned about this administration and the desire to sell off various rights. Give us a sense of where we are in that struggle, because it's an ongoing struggle.
I'm gonna do that, and I'm going to do that without sounding, I hope, like too much of a street corner evangelist, but it's a pretty serious situation. It's about the Grand Canyon as the foreground example, but also all of our national parks and public lands, that whole million square miles that we are the proprietors of and that we own. Under the Trump administration, especially, there's been an acceleration of the use of these public lands for private purposes. We are selling them off at a much faster rate now for logging and for grazing and for oil and gas drilling and for mining at really bargain basement prices. At Grand Canyon, the rocks are always going to be there. That's great. But those living natural systems, their future is really at risk. We're already selling off the air. The air quality in Grand Canyon has really been severely compromised by smog. The water is at risk from real estate developments at the edge of the canyon that are going to that threaten to suck that water out of the ground, and it will no longer go into the canyon to feed all that beautiful wildlife. And all around the canyon, in the public lands north of the canyon, which are especially important, all of those industrialization factors are being pursued just really heedlessly. The logging on the national forest is slated to jump by 31%. That was a Trump administration executive order just a month ago. And oil and gas leases on federal lands have tripled since President Trump took office. So stop me before I crash. Those are
wow. I mean, there are many.
A few of the examples.
Well, there are many threats to these national parks. Would you say that the one that is posed by politicians and the prevailing interests that control them, as you suggest, to extract these various riches, is that at the highest level or tier on your list of concerns?
It really isn't. There's a sort of an umbrella concern for all of us here. And, of course, it's about the whole American continent as well as the Grand Canyon and those glorious public lands. Climate change is going to mean that all of the plants and animals in Grand Canyon and to the north and south are going to need to migrate to stay within the kind of climate envelope that they've evolved within. To stay within their tolerances. Well, I said all of them, that's a bit of an overstatement. Many of them, perhaps most of them, are going to have to migrate north. And right now, they can do that because there are public lands, national forests, national rangelands, wilderness areas, wildlife refuges. A beautiful big swath of them stretch north of Grand Canyon and south of Grand Canyon, all the way to the Canadian border. All of our other national parks have similar opportunities for those species to move along with the heat to stay alive, to survive. We have to connect and protect those public lands for that to happen. Climate change is going to be pushing all of those species very soon.
In your book, you remind us that 96% of what the National Park Service lands encompass are in areas where warming's effects began in the 20th century, and we've seen die-offs already, and lots of concern by the Nature Conservancy and others about plant life in those places.
Yes, that comes from a recent study of what national parks have been reporting in terms of climatic changes over the last few decades, really. And they've actually been impacted more than the rest of the landscape, partly because so many of our national parks are in beautiful mountainous areas and higher elevations have been gathering that heat much more quickly. It's astonishing to think of, but parks like Yosemite in California are going to be, in terms of their climate, more like the climate of the Mexican border by the end of this century. And Yosemite will be a couple of hundred miles to the south in just a few decades. The same is true for Grand Canyon and Yellowstone National Park, to take another example. Yellowstone is going to move from way up there in Wyoming and Montana all the way down to southern Utah before too many decades go by in terms of how hot it's going to be. And that's not even considering the amount of drought they're going to experience.
Explain to us, you quote from a Yale study, that the inflexibility of current park boundaries is the Achilles heel for species preservation on these public lands. Well, explain what you're saying there.
Once again, the for that migration to occur, for those plants and animals to be able to survive as species by moving across the landscape, they can't be confined to a national park. They have to be able to move along into the national forests and into the wildlife refuges and other public lands. But those public lands aren't protected at the level of national parks. What we have to do is consolidate them and then raise the levels of protection. Stop breaking them up by mining and drilling and logging and grazing them. So that in effect we get one big national park in terms of how much we protect it in order to keep that living system alive.
Well, you know, you talk about a lot of pecking orders and ecosystems, and I would love later for you to explain that so people really can see the interrelatedness of so many things. But while we're talking about this, help us understand this. We've got a National Park Service, a Bureau of Land Management. We've got the Forest Service. We've got Fish and Wildlife. So we've got all these jurisdictional issues that we're facing and struggles among various federal agencies. What is the pecking order and what are the implications of those internal bureaucratic struggles?
The way I think of this ranking is in terms of how the wildlife fares under each of them. We know the national parks have a high level of protection, and so do the wilderness areas. The pecking order in terms of protection puts them usually at the top of the list. But those other public lands have varying degrees of protection and sometimes none at all. And we've gotten to a point where even our federally designated wilderness areas have been opened at times to uses like oil and gas drilling. So it's a pretty mixed picture. Also, the national parks themselves are not as well protected as they once were. There have been really astonishing stories of casual sacrifice of values in the national parks, and Grand Canyon, once again, is a great example. Grand Canyon is home to the largest fleet of helicopters in the world. They are very noisy helicopters, and the solitude that once used to be available to people who took a short hike away from the roads in Grand Canyon is no longer there. Helicopters are really loud. They disrupt wildlife, and when surveys have been taken of people who are hiking or backpacking in the canyon, that aircraft noise is one of the chief complaints that people have, usually the chief complaint.
We're talking about the book Grand Canyon for Sale with Stephen Nash. And Stephen, maybe the condor and the plight of the North American condor might help people understand this gentle, precious, fragile ecosystem that we're talking about.
Condor is a wonderful story, and when you go to Grand Canyon, you can hear it frequently in some of those really nice ranger talks that are given in the evenings at national parks. It's a great story for them to tell because in some ways it's a success story. The condors have been gone from Grand Canyon for about a century. They were just shot. They were predators of grazing animals, and they had other kinds of problems, but they've been there for hundreds of thousands of years. Anyway, they disappeared, and then they were reintroduced in the 1990s. And there was a press conference and big fanfare, as there should have been, that this endangered species, critically endangered, was being brought back to a landscape that it should be part of. Condors are magnificent. They're the largest birds that we have on this continent, a 9-foot wingspan, and you can still see them. They're flying over even the populated areas of Grand Canyon. But the problem is, even though it cost us millions of dollars to reintroduce them, they're dying off as quickly as we can put them back. And the reason for that is because they eat carrion. They're scavengers. And hunters in the area, some of them, insist on using lead ammunition. The condors eat the lead ammunition. It gets caught in their throats. And they get lead poisoning. So we have to keep recapturing them and treating them really arduously and painfully. And then if they don't die, they're re-released. And occasionally there are new condors, new baby condors, and they've been helping repopulate. But these animals die off time and again. The main cause of death isn't natural causes. It's ingesting that lead shot. That's because state legislatures and especially the federal government just refuse to outlaw that kind of ammunition on our federal public lands. So there's a national forest right next to Grand Canyon. And in that national forest during hunting season, you can hunt deer or whatever else you're hunting using lead shots still. And the condors are just barely hanging on. If we didn't keep propping them up and, in effect, hospitalizing them, they'd be gone again.
Invasive species, things that are not domestically involved and have come from far away and had an impact on the entire ecosystem of many of these parks and lands. You want to give us a good illustration of that and how pervasive this issue is?
My cousin Howard and I went camping in the most remote area of Grand Canyon you can get to by car, at least the most remote one I know of. It's called Two Weep. You have to go over 60 miles of really bad road to get there. So it is really in the far outback of this quite wild national park. It's a great place and has one of those iconic kind of southwestern landscapes all around it down at the western end of the canyon. So here we are, this real American-looking, super remote wilderness place. But actually, there are many species of plants from Asia and Africa and Europe that have kind of infested that part of Grand Canyon and have infested lots of our public lands. These plants are displacing native species. They are plants often that our native wildlife can't eat or won't eat, and they're extremely hard to get rid of. They're not there by accident. They're there because we refuse to pass trade laws and inspection laws that keep new invaders like that out. If you live in the east and you've heard of kudzu, or if you live in the south and you've heard of Argentine fire ants or killer bees, all of those are examples, just like the ones there at Grand Canyon. Species that we've let in carelessly, we know better, but we're still doing it because of the political pressures that keep making that possible.
And you talk about those political pressures, and yet you also point to the fact that whether you're a Republican or you're a Democrat, national parks have huge public support. I mean, almost universal. So what's going on here? Why is the public's voice? I know whenever I've gone to a national park and signed up for a lifetime membership and supporting some of the private groups that come in to help out, I mean, everybody loves the experience they have at a national park, even though we know they're underfunded and we know at times they're not as well kept as we'd like. But why is it that our voice means nothing when there's such universal support?
70% of Americans in the latest poll that I saw have concluded, and these are both Republicans and Democrats, that Congress is for sale. They've concluded that on the basis of a long, long string of examples that have been growing more and more numerous throughout recent years, and this preceded the current administration, examples where a relatively modest interest group, along with the great big, well-funded corporations, can logjam the legislative system. And in the case of the national parks, they do that at the expense of protecting the national parks. So there's a lot of money behind the groups that don't want tighter trade regulations. But sometimes even smaller groups of people can find their way to Congress with campaign finance funds, and they are able to have the kind of influence, it's legal, but it looks corrupt to many of us, the kind of influence that means that not only the Grand Canyon or the public lands are sacrificed, but the whole credibility of our political system is also sacrificed. And, you know, on the optimistic side, there are laws being introduced to change that. We'll just see if a majority in Congress can be mustered to clean up that really nightmare situation.
Is this human threat to these wonderful, special, protected places under some siege and attack also from state and local officials? You talk about this case of the Grupo Stilo development plans near Grand Canyon. What's going on the state and local level?
The same corporate interests, the same really effective lobbying that's been going on behalf of those corporate interests has made its way into state legislatures. And state legislators and their political allies in Congress, all of them backed up by the same kind of campaign money, have been advocating breaking up public lands and either selling them off outright to private interests or putting them back under state control. This is the same situation that Grand Canyon faced 100 years ago when Teddy Roosevelt got interested in promoting the idea of making it a national park and trying to protect it. It was local interests who saw immediate economic gain as being much more important than putting the national park aside from those commercial pressures and protecting it for the whole of the nation on into the future. That's what's happening now. The state of Arizona passed a law, the legislature did actually, stating that all federal lands in Arizona should be turned over to the state. Luckily, the governor thought that was too crazy. She was actually a Tea Party Republican, but too crazy for her, so she wouldn't sign it. But that would have made Grand Canyon and all of the other public lands in Arizona wards of the state. And it specifically said this this law, which was approved by both houses, it specifically said that any time it wanted to, the state could sell those lands off to private interests. That's been going on in several of our western states.
You also have a concern about the prevalence of what you call regulatory capture. And yet many of these regulators, I mean, people who go into the National Park Service or Forest Management or Bureau of Land Management, I mean, they're people who really do care about these places. What is this regulatory capture?
Regulatory capture is when an agency that is supposed to be looking out for protecting endangered species, for instance, or keeping invasive species out of the country, or maybe its task is, like the National Park Service, to protect the Grand Canyon as much as it can. It's when those regulatory agencies, instead of working on behalf of the public interest, have kind of been taken over by private interests. And it works very simply. If you work at the Agriculture Department agency that's supposed to be keeping out invasive species, and you're doing your job, and your inspections are careful, and you keep turning up insects and exotic plants that aren't supposed to come in, you're going to upset certain economic interests. They're going to get in touch with their congressional representatives, and the congressperson is going to come and talk to the head of the agency whose budget depends on that same Congress. He doesn't want the political pressure, and to the degree that he feels or she feels she has to cave in to those pressures, the protection is going to disappear. Here's an example from Grand Canyon of a few years ago. The superintendent who was in charge at Grand Canyon then decided that plastic bottles, those throwaway plastic bottles in their tens of millions, were a menace to Grand Canyon National Park, and they had already been banned successfully at another national park. Instead, you were supposed to bring in non-disposable bottle for your water. What happened at that point was that the Coca-Cola people got involved up in Washington. They put pressure on the leader of the whole national park system, and the word came down from him that you couldn't ban plastic bottles at Grand Canyon, that was going to be delayed indefinitely for further study. They made their influence felt, and even the National Park Service caved. You know, we can't ask our public officials to sacrifice their careers every time a congressperson comes in the door on behalf of a private interest. Yes, we wish they all were super courageous, but frankly, few of us are that courageous either. What we have to do instead of expecting people to be superheroes on our behalf and on behalf of the national parks, what we have to do instead is reform the political system so they're protected and allowed to do their jobs.
One of the best things that you can do as a citizen is to read this book, honestly. Get yourself up to speed about all of the implications of what we're talking about today, and then talk to someone in authority, wherever you are, or your legislators on the federal level. Stephen Nash, you've given us great information to get to them with. Grand Canyon for Sale, Public Land versus Private Interests in the Era of Climate Change. Thank you so much for being with us today on America Trends.
And thank you.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network, MHNRnetwork.com.